Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive.
Today we are getting stuck into a word that, well, it often just stops conversations dead in their tracks. Ideology. We're looking at Michael Friedan's really, really insightful book, Ideology, a very short introduction.
Yeah, and it's so important because, let's face it, for ages, ideology has basically been a dirty word.
Yeah.
You know, if I say your ideas are ideological, I'm probably dismissing them.
Right, you're saying they're rigid, or maybe, like, going back to Marx, it's false consciousness or something. It's like an attack word.
Totally. An intellectual punch, as you said.
Exactly. So our mission today, it's pretty straightforward. We want to give you a kind of conceptual shortcut. We're going to unpack Friedan's framework. He calls it the morphological approach. It's a neutral, analytical way to get what ideology actually is.
Mm-hmm. And why it's maybe unavoidable rather than just this, you know, bad thing that only other people seem to have. And why does this matter for you listening? Well, you get this like systematic lens. You can start to see beneath all the shouting in politics.
Yeah, you stop just asking, are they right or wrong? Which can be, frankly, a dead end sometimes. And you start asking, okay, what's the underlying map they're using? How is it structured? It's a much more useful question, I think.
Definitely more insightful.
Okay, so before we start unfolding this map, maybe we should talk a little about the person who drew it up, Michael Friedan. He's emeritus professor of politics at Oxford. I mean, he's globally known as a top political theorist, especially on this very topic.
Right, and his really unique contribution, the thing that underpins this whole book, is the morphological approach. It's more than just a theory, isn't it? It's like a method, a system for analyzing political thinking.
Exactly. It focuses on the structure, the form, not just the surface content. He didn't just, you know, talk about ideology. He kind of gave us a new grammar to understand its language.
And it seems like his whole career has been about this one big project, trying to rehabilitate the concept of ideology.
Yeah, rescuing it, sort of, moving it away from just being a political insult and making it a serious central thing we need to analyze in politics. He's really interested in how these ideas actually work in the real world, not just in abstract philosophical debates.
And he walked the talk, too. He applies this framework to dissect actual political systems, liberalism, socialism, conservatism, you name it. Plus, he founded and edited the Journal of Political Ideologies for a long time.
Oh, yeah. A really prestigious journal. So he definitely connects that high-level theory with, you know, practical political analysis.
Okay, let's get to the heart of it then. The central argument, which, honestly, it really reframes how you think about political beliefs. Friedan's main point is this. Ideologies aren't distortions. They're not lies. They're not just propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, he says they are dynamic, indispensable, and permanent conceptual maps. They map out the political world for us.
And we need these maps, right? Because the political world is just inherently messy. It's ambiguous. These ideological systems, they organize concepts that Friedan calls essentially contested.
Things like liberty, justice, equality, security.
Exactly. Stuff everyone agrees is important, but nobody agrees on exactly what it means. There's no universal dictionary definition that settles it.
And that's the big shift, isn't it? The book really walks you through this realization that having an ideology isn't some kind of intellectual flaw or, you know, being dogmatic. It's actually fundamental. It's inescapable.
You can't really do politics without some kind of map telling you what the key landmarks mean and how they relate to each other.
Yeah, absolutely. And the ambition here is pretty big. Friedan's essentially giving us a new, more sophisticated grammar for understanding political disagreements.
So when you apply this, you stop seeing someone you disagree with as just, well, irrational or stupid.
Right. You start recognizing, okay, they're operating from a different map. It might be structured differently. It might prioritize different things. But it's often internally coherent from their perspective. They've just defined the terms differently. Okay, so to understand how these maps get built, we kind of have to acknowledge the shadow they've been under, historically speaking. You mentioned Marx earlier.
Yeah, that idea of false consciousness has been hugely influential. The belief that ideology is just there to cover up exploitation, to stop people seeing the real economic situation.
And Friedan says, look, that historical baggage, it's too narrow. It's often politically motivated itself.
Mm-hmm. He offers a more functional, neutral definition. He says ideologies are basically systems of political thinking through which individuals and groups construct an understanding of the political world and then act on that understanding.
So it's about making sense of things so you can actually do something.
Precisely. It structures understanding so collective action becomes possible.
And the raw material for this structure. You mentioned these political concepts, liberty, rights, order, community. But the big problem he spots is that they are essentially contested.
Right. Think about security. On one political map, security might mean a huge military, strong borders. On another map, it could mean universal health care, job security, climate action.
Same word, totally different core meaning depending on the map.
Exactly. So the main job of an ideology, according to Friedan, is this process called decontestation.
Decontestation.
Yeah.
Like removing the contest.
Yeah, essentially. It takes these slippery, ambiguous concepts and it fixes them, gives them a specific, temporarily stable meaning by linking them together within its structure.
Can you give an example?
Sure. Think about, say, a strong anti-tax ideology. It will likely take individual freedom and link it super tightly to property rights. That's the core connection. And then a concept like economic equality gets pushed way out to the edges of the map, or maybe even off it. It's decontested by prioritizing freedom as property.
Got it. And this leads us right into the core of his theory, the morphological approach.
Morphology is just the study of form and structure. Simple as that. So for Friedan, it's the way an ideology arranges these concepts, the structure it builds, that defines it. That's what makes liberalism different from socialism or conservatism.
Okay, and he uses this analogy, right, like a conceptual solar system.
Yeah, it's a really helpful way to visualize it. He talks about three levels of importance for concepts within an ideology.
So at the very center, the sun, the thing with all the gravitational pull, that's the core concept.
Right. The absolute non-negotiable, the load-bearing pillar.
Yeah.
If you take pure liberalism, the core is almost always liberty.
And for classic socialism?
Equality, usually. For traditional conservatism, maybe order or tradition. It's the defining principle.
Okay, so that's the core. Then what?
Then, orbiting really close to that core, you have the adjacent concepts. Those are crucial because they define and qualify the core. They tell you what kind of liberty or equality we're talking about.
So for liberalism, with liberty at the core, adjacent concepts would be?
Things like rights, individualism, maybe reason. These tell you it's about rational individual liberty secured by rights. It's not necessarily about, say, collective liberation in the same way.
Makes sense. And the third level?
Those are the peripheral concepts. They're further out, less critical to the ideology's basic identity, and their meaning is pretty much dictated by the core and adjacent concepts.
You mentioned democracy earlier as an example.
Yeah, perfect example. In early liberalism, democracy was often peripheral. The core concept of liberty, defined through individual property rights, sometimes meant that things like universal suffrage were actually seen as a potential threat to liberty. So democracy's meaning and importance were secondary.
Wow. And what's really powerful is how changing that core concept just changes everything.
It's like shifting the sun in that solar system. If you suddenly make, I don't know, market efficiency the absolute core of conservatism, replacing order or tradition.
And then things like community or national identity, which used to be adjacent maybe, suddenly have their meanings and importance totally changed. They get pulled into a different orbit.
Exactly. The whole map warps. The relationships all shift.
Okay, so we've got the structure of the map. What does the map actually do for people or groups? You mentioned decontestation.
That's the primary function, he argues. Think about it. If every key political term means something different to everyone, how can you ever agree on a goal or coordinate action? It's impossible.
Right, you just argue forever about what justice means.
Precisely. Decontestation is the process that temporarily stops the argument within a particular group. It takes a fluid concept like the people or justice and presents the ideology's specific interpretation as just, normal, as common sense.
Everyone knows justice means X.
Exactly. When a political movement successfully does that, they've performed decontestation. It allows them to mobilize people around their definition.
But hang on, if the ideology itself is creating what feels like common sense, how do we, you know, step outside that? How do we see the structure if we're sort of living inside it?
That's the challenge. And that's why the morphological approach is so useful. It gives you the analytical tools to look at the structure rather than just arguing from within it about whose definition of freedom is right.
So besides decontestation, what else do ideologies do?
Well, Friedan lists several other functions. They provide explanation, they tell a story about why the world is the way it is, they offer evaluation criteria for judging political actions as good or bad, they give orientation, helping people find their identity, a sense of belonging within a group, and they usually provide a political program, a set of prescriptions for action.
And this framework, it applies to today's politics too, like with populism.
Oh, absolutely. Frieden has written about this. He describes populism as a thin ideology.
Thin, meaning?
Simple.
Yeah, its core structure is very simple, usually just a conflict between the pure people and the corrupt elite. That's the central axis. But that doesn't tell you much about, say, tax policy or healthcare.
Exactly. It's thin because it lacks that rich network of adjacent and peripheral concepts to provide a full worldview or detailed policies. So what does it do? It has to latch onto a thicker host ideology.
Like nationalism or socialism.
Precisely. It borrows the thicker ideology's concepts and structure to fill in the gaps, to give it substance on specific issues. So you can have right-wing populism attached to nationalism or left-wing populism attached to socialism.
So ideology isn't dying out, as some people used to say.
Not at all, according to Frieden. It's just changing its shape, adapting, morphing, you might say. Okay, so let's try and boil this down. What are the absolute key takeaways, the things Frieden really wants you to get from this?
Right, the high value points. Number one for me has to be this idea. Ideology is a cognitive necessity. It's not a bug, it's a feature. It's an essential tool humans use to make sense of the incredibly complex political world.
You literally can't navigate without some kind of map, however basic or flawed.
Yep. Exactly. So a reflection point here. Next time you hear someone say they're purely pragmatic or not ideological, pause. Recognize that that stance itself probably rests on an unseen ideological foundation, maybe one that prioritizes efficiency or common sense above all else.
Good point. Which leads straight to the second big theme, rejecting the ideology versus truth dichotomy. Frieden basically says there's no escaping ideology. There isn't some neutral objective ground of pure truth in politics that you can stand on.
All political thinking, even claiming to be non-ideological, have foundational assumptions, core concepts, a structure.
Right. So the choice isn't between having an ideology and having the objective truth. It's always a choice among competing ideological maps.
It really changes how you approach political disagreement.
Mm.
Okay. Third theme. This gets back to the mechanism. Meaning is contextual morphology. The structure is everything.
Yeah. The difference between, say, a classical liberal and a social democrat isn't just that they disagree on the definition of equality. It's about how they position equality relative to the core concept of liberty on their respective maps.
One might see equality as adjacent to liberty, maybe even necessary for it, while the other sees it as peripheral or even potentially undermining liberty if pushed too far.
Exactly. It's a structural clash, a difference in the conceptual architecture, not just a dictionary dispute.
Okay, and finally, an important distinction he makes. Ideology and political philosophy are different beasts.
Mm-hmm. They have different goals. Political philosophy, you know, the academic kind, is usually aiming for logical consistency, maybe universal truth claims. It's analytical.
Whereas ideology,
yeah,
its job is different, right?
Yeah, ideology is about mobilization, persuasion, building group identity, integrating society. It's designed for mass politics, for action. So we shouldn't judge an ideology using only the strict standards of academic philosophy. We need to understand its own political and social functions.
You know, Frieden has a knack for phrasing things in a way that really sticks. Some of the core ideas are quite memorable.
Absolutely. I think one of the most confronting but useful insights, maybe the best bit of advice, is basically this. The most dangerous political stance is to believe you don't have an ideology.
Why dangerous?
Because that lack of self-awareness about your own map, your own assumptions, means you can't critically examine them. You're flying blind, in a way. That's the real risk.
That makes sense. And this one really captures how political movements work. Every ideology functions by decontestation. We talked about that. By removing the essential contestability from political concepts and providing specific interpretations.
Yeah, that explains how they create that feeling of common sense or inevitability around their ideas. They nail down the meaning of freedom or justice for their audience, making it seem like the only natural way to think about it.
It's how they build consensus for action. And the third one, the bedrock rule of his whole approach, change the core concept of an ideology, and the meaning of every other concept changes with it.
That's the fundamental principle of morphological analysis.
Yeah.
Touch the core and the whole system reconfigures. It's incredibly powerful for understanding political change.
Okay, so this is all fascinating theory, but how can you, listening right now, actually use this toolkit?
Yeah.
How does it apply day to day?
Well, the first and maybe most immediate thing is using it for decoding political language. When you hear a politician speak or read an article, try to stop just hearing the words like freedom or security. Ask yourself, okay, what seems to be the core concept here? What's being prioritized above all else? Is the speaker using security in a way that makes privacy seem secondary or unimportant?
Or are they using community in a way that reshapes what individual rights traditionally means within that framework? You start listening for the structure, not just the buzzwords.
Yeah. And second, this can actually help foster more productive dialogue, which, let's be honest, is desperately needed.
Tell me about it. Instead of immediately dismissing someone you disagree with as irrational or, you know, evil, try applying the morphological lens. Recognize they're likely operating from a different, but possibly internally coherent, map.
So if you're arguing about, say, healthcare, realize it might be a clash between one map that puts individual choice or liberty at the absolute core and another map that puts universal equality or social solidarity at the core.
Then maybe you can have a more constructive conversation about those underlying structures and priorities, rather than just yelling past each other about specific policies. Maybe?
It's worth a try. And the third application, which is maybe the hardest but most crucial, is critical self-awareness.
Turning the lens on yourself.
Exactly. Use this framework to reflect. What is my core political concept, really? When push comes to shove, is it liberty, order, equality, something else? And how does that core assumption shape my views on other things? Taxes, climate change, immigration?
Knowing your own map is the first step towards thinking more critically and consciously about your own political engagement. You know, thinking back on this, what surprised me most, I think, was how convincingly Frieden argues that ideology isn't some historical mistake we can just grow out of. He defines it as this ongoing cognitive necessity.
Yeah, that really struck me too. It means political disagreement, the clash of these maps, it's not going away. It's a permanent feature of human social life. It'll just keep evolving, keep morphing.
Which is maybe a bit daunting, but also kind of realistic.
I agree. And that leaves us perhaps with a final thought for you to ponder. Remember that politics, seen through this lens, isn't really a search for the one single correct path forward. It's more like a continuous battle between competing, often internally consistent conceptual maps.
And the biggest power you have in that battle.
Maybe it's simply the ability to recognize the map you are using and the maps others are using before you decide where to go next. That self-awareness, that analytical clarity, that's the starting point for truly critical thinking.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker. Another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.